it's always a sign that the university must be doing something right when one of their graduates achieves great distinction in his field. And this is the case with our speaker this morning, who received his PhD from the University of Virginia in 74. And today we especially want to give an opportunity to his examiners at that time to raise any questions, which there wasn't time to raise when he received his PhD. A number of them are around the table. Professor Suleiman Nayang is a director of African Studies at Howard University. He came to the University of Virginia as a Thomas Jefferson scholar from the Hampton Institute. He went briefly to Howard, but then entered the Gambian Foreign Service and was head of Chancery and deputy head of mission in Saudi Arabia, accredited to 8 other countries, including Iran. He knew many Middle East students here, a Lebanese student, a Libyan student, and a number of others. The Libyan student went back and entered the Foreign Service, but like Mr. Schultz, found that life with Gaddafi was not the most pleasant thing in the world, and so went to Benghazi and became chairman of the political science department there. After a period in the Foreign Service, Dr. Nayang returned to Howard University and has been a distinguished scholar there since that time. He's the author of the book Islam, Christianity, and African Identity, History, Political Analysis in Contemporary Africa, comparing especially the leadership roles of Senghor with his emphasis on Negritude and Nkrumah with his emphasis on Pan-Africanism. He's written numerous articles on Gambian politics, probably more than anyone alive. He's written also on Islam and politics. He has branched out as far in his writing as studies of Pakistan, and has written one of the few existing studies of the organization of the Islamic Conference. He has a recent chapter in a book on the politics of the Islamic revivalism, and has written on Saudi politics toward the Horn of Africa as well. He happens to be a good friend of our speaker of 2 weeks ago, Ali Mazrui, and he made an interesting comment. Mazrui, in the eyes of the left in Africa, is looked upon as a CIA agent and an utter reactionary, which is interesting in as much as the Africans was criticized in this country as being too liberal. So Mazrui must be doing something right in as much as he gets it from both sides. But the discussion today is a continuation of our discussion of constitutionalism, and we're especially pleased that with this vast background of experience and knowledge, Professor Nayang would speak on the impact of U.S. constitutionalism in Africa, a Gambian case study. It's a great privilege to have you with us.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to return home to UVA. I have fond memories of this campus, and I'm very flattered to have my professors in this room this afternoon. When we talk about constitutionalism and the impact of the U.S. Constitution on African governments, we have to take into account several factors. The first important point is that the American Revolution was a major development in world history. It was significant, in my view, on two grounds. One, it looked very peculiar at the time to be a Republican at that particular juncture in world history. We take it for granted today because many of us call ourselves Republicans, I mean in terms of forms of government. But the American Revolution brought into the world system a new day, when you can aspire to position of leadership, not because of blood, but because you are chosen by your fellow citizens. That was a major development in world history. Prior to that, we had the divine rights of kings, and men were rulers simply because of their genealogy, or simply because they felt that they deserved to rule. And of course, our philosophers and political thinkers justified this and wrote treaties to make that point. The second reason why the American Revolution was significant was the fact that the founding fathers, like Thomas Jefferson and others, were very much concerned about the balance between faith and reason and the creation of human governments to be based either on faith or on reason. In the past, governments were based on faith. Hence, the grounding of government in a transcendental order that rulers are selected indeed by the Almighty. But here, the founding fathers were able to devise a new system which made mankind recognize that there is a need for balance between reason and faith in human governance. And I think with scientific progress and technological breakthroughs in the United States, we have been able to see the manner in which they were able to construct a constitution which is elastic enough to sustain interpretations given the social changes in human society. With this background, I will proceed to look at the manner in which the American Constitution has manifested itself in terms of influence in African societies. The African continent is very diverse. There are over 1,000 ethnic groups and languages. It is very dangerous and unwise to make generalizations. However, one can make certain tentative generalizations based on the historical record or the contemporary record of Africa. When we look at the African political systems, two things come to mind. One is that in the African societies, almost all the African states as we know them now as members of the United Nations were colonized. Ethiopia, of course, was not colonized as Gambia or Nigeria, but Ethiopia suffered some form of colonization from the Italians before they were chased out by the British and other people who were fighting against the fascist groups during the Second World War. So when we look at the African political landscape, we see that the political systems that were created were the creatures of colonial masters. So in terms of American political influence, one can see that there is a fundamental difference between the American constitutional record and the kinds of constitutional development in Africa. When Max Weber defined political systems, of course, he talks about charismatic leadership, patrimonial systems. And of course, when you look at the African reality, you find out that in the pre-colonial period, the type of governments that existed were governments based on patrimonial thinking or patrimonial considerations. Tradition governs the manner in which the political process was carried out. With the arrival of colonialism, the Africans were now subjected to authoritarian rule. Governments were created which were not accountable to the Africans. This was because of the colonial might of the colonial powers. So rules were being formulated by colonialists which affected the manner in which resources were allocated, the dignity and right of the individual was defined, and the interaction between one individual and the other was worked out. So whether the colonial period provided any kind of similarity with the American constitutional process, one would say that the colonial period was authoritarian, and the colonial period did not necessarily create any kind of parallel constitutional development which Americans can see as a mirror image of what has transpired. The only manner in which Americans can see similarities between what transpired in colonized Africa and their own experience is in pre-independent America, America before the revolution, because both the English-speaking African states and the United States went through a British colonial experience. So the manner in which legislation was carried out in pre-revolutionary America was very much echoed in the African experience. So there is a parallel in terms of being members of a community of colonized people. Now, if we look at the post-revolutionary America and the manner in which it has influenced African societies, one will have to look very closely in the post-colonial constitutions and see to what extent the post-colonial African societies reflected American considerations or American thinking. Now, as I pointed out earlier, when you look at the African reality, you have to understand that the Africans come from different countries with different colonial backgrounds and different cultural milieu. So this would affect the process of constitution making and constitution building. With independence, many of the African leaders were very much preoccupied with creating political systems that were not only pluralistic, but at the same time harmonized, to the point that ethnic division does not interfere with the political process sufficiently enough to undermine economic development. This was the dream. And many of these African countries inherited what is called the Westminster parliamentary form of government. Now, the Westminster model created a second stage in the constitutional development of African societies that were colonized by the British. Of course, one can identify a different pattern of constitutional development in the French-speaking countries. The same thing can be done for the Portuguese territories. But since the Gambia falls under the category of English-speaking African states, I would focus on the English-speaking countries. And the patterns that have emerged since independence is that you have countries like the Gambia, Botswana, and Lesotho, these are small countries compared to others, where the constitutional process has been a replication of what has transpired either in England or in America with some modification. And then you have countries like Nigeria, and I believe Dr. Gambari came here to speak about the Nigerian experience, where you had the military experience. The constitutional process in the case of Nigeria has been interfered with by the intrusion of the military in the political development of that society. So it is against this background of diverse experiences and differential rate of constitutional development that one can look at the Gambia. Now, when you look at the Gambian political system, what you find is that the Gambia is a classic example of a colonized mini-state. In many respects, it can fit the description of Aristotle's Politeia if the political process is carefully monitored by the leadership, and if you have an enlightened leadership at the top who are in a position to create a political system where all the attributes of a constitutional democracy are reflected in the political process. Secondly, in the case of the Gambia, you have an agrarian system. There is a preference for agrarian polity on the part of Aristotle, because he felt that maybe the best political system would be the one built on agriculture. So the majority of the Gambians are agricultural people. So in that respect, there is proximity to the ideal of the Aristotelian dream of the Politeia. However, the reality of the Gambian political system belies some of these expectations. One is the fact that in the Gambia you have ethnic diversity. So the Gambian political leaders who move the country towards independence were not only faced with an autocratic colonial system, but they were also faced with competition among the ethnic groups in the society. So in the post-colonial period, there was an attempt on the part of the leadership to create a political system that would reflect the aspirations of the people and at the same time allow the oppositional groups to register their presence and their disagreement with the policies of the government. Now, the British colonial authorities introduced constitutional government, however limited that may be, in the colonial period as early as 1843. At that time, selective representation was brought about, and in this case, there are parallels with the American pre-revolutionary experience when certain categories or certain social classes were allowed to participate in the political process. So if we are looking for American elements in the Gambian constitutional experience, we might very well pick out these building blocks that most probably were quarried from the same place as those building blocks in the pre-revolutionary American constitutional development. Now, from 1843 right up to 1965, when Gambia became independent from Britain, a number of constitutions were developed by the British, depending on the political development in the society and the effects of social mobilization in the Gambian society. The pattern of development can be identified in this manner, that at the beginning, those moneyed classes in the urban areas of the Gambia were allowed to participate in the political process, even though the governor was virtually the autocrat who dictated the terms and the colonial officers exercised hegemony. This was the same thing that happened in Virginia before Patrick Henry and others were saying, give me liberty or give me that. The reality that happened in the Gambia was that at a later stage, the British introduced a provision in the constitution which says that people who own property, that means to say, they call them rate payers, those who pay the rates. You have to pay the rates to the colonial local government in order to be qualified to be put on the rolls. So if you don't pay yard tax or rate tax, you are not eligible. So in this case, the constitutional right to participate in the political process was determined by your ability to pay the rate tax. So if you didn't pay the rate tax, you were excluded. And of course, this created some kind of a democratic aristocracy of some sort. You had an aristocracy of the rate payers who were allowed by the colonial government to participate in the political process. There are echoes of this in the American experience. Now, with the coming of independence in 65, the Gambian leaders who were agitating for independence felt that the new constitution that was to be agreed upon at Lancaster House should reflect the political ambition and the dreams of the Gambian people. So the product of their negotiation with the British colonial officers at Lancaster House was the independence constitution of 65. Now, a careful examination of this independent constitution of 1965 will reveal elements of the American experience. The American experience put forth a government which recognized a Bill of Rights. You have the leader is selected on the basis of popular vote. You have representational government, which is very much an American contribution to world political theory. The freedom of religion, which is very critical, even though the majority of Gambians are Muslims, you do have sizable Christian minority who are in the society. There are a few Baha'is in the hundreds, and of course other groups. So the insertion in the Gambian Constitution of 65, the provision of religious freedom, echoes the Virginia Constitution, which Jefferson wrote with regard to religious liberties, and of course the American Constitution, which talks about the separation of of church and state. Now, but very much like the Americans, the separation of church and state does not preclude the appreciation of the faith of the majority. And this is very much done when the president of the Gambia, or the prime minister at the time, takes the oath of office. He takes the oath of office, putting his right hand on a holy book. So, in this case, some may see it as a contradiction with regard to the separation of church and state. But I think this is a tradition that is not written into the Constitution of the Gambia. It's not done in the United States either. But the custom that has been established in America, and of course, which was done by the British kings themselves, was also incorporated in the Gambia. So in this case, American customs and practices with regard to the assumption of political power is adopted in this country. The other point that needs to be borne in mind is that in the Gambia Constitution of 65, you have the freedom of assembly, freedom of speech, freedom of movement, and the protection of the dignity of the person. All these are really virtual plagiarization of the American Constitution by all the other African constitutions. So, in many respects, the American experience, which by 1960 has proven to be a very meaningful contribution to world political development, was now found desirable enough to be accepted. Now, a British constitutional historian may take issue with me in saying, well, this was more a copying of the British than an American. But here, I'm willing to go part of the way with Gladstone, who tries to compare American constitution with the British constitution by saying that the American constitution, of course, was something that was created and made by men, whereas, it was something that was formulated and thought out and written out by men, and then they tried to live up to it. Whereas in the case of the British constitution, it evolved in time as the society developed. So in a case, the Gambian's constitution of 65 reflects much of the liberties that are aspired for by Americans and have realized in the two centuries of constitutional development. When compared to the Americans, I would say the Gambians, in their attempt to build a democratic constitutionalism, are at the aspirational stage. So it is a constitutive ideal. Democracy as a constitutive ideal exists in the Gambia, and it is only history that will prove whether the Gambian experiment succeeded or not. The Americans have 200 years to look back to, and they can say, well, our ancestors faced their trials and tribulations, but they were able to work out a deal among themselves. So the politics of compromise and bargaining has yielded good results. And we are the beneficiaries of institutional and ideational formulation and development. So the Gambian leaders were able to develop a constitutional form of government which reflected the American ideal when the Gambia became a republic. Because in 1970, we witnessed the last stage in the development of Gambian constitutionalism. In 1970, the Gambian electorate was asked to vote on a constitution. The difference between the 1965 constitution and the 1970 constitution was that in the 1970 constitution, the Gambians decided to have their prime minister replace the Queen of England as the head of government. And in this case, the Gambians have traveled the whole mile as the Americans, in the sense that they were now saying, we want to be truly Republican, and we do not want to have a monarch. And our leader is not going to be elected to be the emperor of the Gambians. He is being elected for a specific term, and he can leave office at our sufferance. So if we decide to keep him till he dies in office, that is our choice. But it is not his choice to be in office. That's a major contribution of American political thought, that you can be a leader, you can be an imperial president, or what people like Maslow will call a monarchical president in Africa, but you are a monarchy with a term of office. That's a new invention from America. I mean, people like Hamilton, of course, would have liked George Washington to be a king, George the First, but that, of course, did not carry the day. And I think the Gambians have traveled the same road that the Americans have been traveling now. Whereas the Americans have locked 200 years, the Gambians have only about 24 years of constitutional development. In the 1970 constitution, the Gambians work out a provision to the effect that they will live in a society which is pluralistic, and that the constitution will determine who is elected for what particular term in office, and when is he liable to be prosecuted or impeached by the judiciary. So in a sense, what we have in the Gambian experience is a democracy that recognizes the separation of church and state, the freedom of the individual, and the ability of men to agree among themselves as to how political differences can be settled without resorting to violence. Because the bottom line of constitutional development really is the use of reason in the resolution of conflict among men. Because men are social creatures who are faced with the daily challenge of resolving conflict over property, over the protection of person, and over space. These are the critical issues all human beings are faced with. And in the Gambian experience, there is an attempt to make sure that the rule of law is respected. Now, there is one point which makes the Gambian experience different from the American experience. It is true that President Washington was a charismatic figure in the early history of the Republic, but there were many powerful men, men of substance and influence, like Mr. Jefferson, who were around and who used their intellect and all the wherewithal the Almighty gave them at the time to make sure that a government of laws prevail. In the Gambian experience, the constitutional experiment is potentially in jeopardy because one man, meaning the current president of the country, has been the most dominating personality in the political process. And there are many political observers who believe that constitutional rule is really pegged on him. Some of us are hoping that this is not the case, that you do have a large number of Gambian politicians who are equally committed to the democratic process and should President Jawara depart from the scene, then someone else equally capable and equally committed to the democratic process would take over the system and democracy would prevail in the Gambia. What the president has been able to do in the Gambia is to recognize the right of the opposition, which is a critical element in terms of constitutional democracy. Because if you do not allow the opposition to register their grievances, chances are the issues are not going to be fully discussed. Opinions would carry the day as decrees of those in power. But by recognizing freedom of speech, right of assembly in the Constitution, you create a fertile ground for opposition to any policy pursued by the government. And if the principle of rationality is elevated to the position of determining what is right and what is wrong in the society, then the governors who committed errors yesterday will have the moral courage to admit failure tomorrow. And that is only possible in a democratic society, because dictators will always try to hide their mistakes by insisting that they are right. And in doing so, many would lose their life in trying to talk them into abandoning old policies. And in this case, the Gambians find themselves very much in that situation. Now, when I talk about Gambia's constitutional development and American impact on the African states, I should conclude by saying that the Gambian experiment is a rare experiment in Africa today. Very few African states have multi-party system, but the number is growing slowly. The Nigerians are in the process of returning to civilian rule. They have been trying to build a political order, but as President Seyi Sagari pointed out, in Nigeria there are only two political parties, the military and the civilians. And unfortunately, the military has continued to take power because they don't go to the ballot box. We have seen in Africa military men who have followed what I call the Nasserite model of Egypt. Military men who try to project themselves as legitimate rulers of society by civilianizing themselves. Somehow there is this belief that if I put on coat and tie instead of khaki uniforms, I will automatically be a civilian politician and I'll be legitimized by my looks. And of course, this is precisely what has happened in Egypt, and the Nasserite model has been copied by people like Mobutu Sese Seko in establishing political parties and then try to get legitimacy that way. And then, of course, constitutions will then be written up and the leader will try to justify his role by saying, I now have popular support and the constitution that is now governing the country is based on a referendum or a plebiscite in which the majority of our electorate voted in favor of my position. And this is precisely what people like Mobutu Sese Seko are trying to do in Zaire. The Gambian model is also different from the experiment that is going on in Ghana today. In Ghana, you have a military dictatorship that has tried since 1981-82 to legitimize itself by creating pockets of support throughout the society. And even though the leader, Rawlings, now claims to be building up a society where people can participate in the political process, and the Chief Justice has been elevated to the number two position in the government, there is still room for doubt as to whether a constitutional democracy is really in the cards for Ghana. The Ghanaian experience is very sad because Ghana was the first African country to become independent. And when President Nkrumah of Ghana took over in Ghana, many Americans were very optimistic, hoping that this graduate of an American university would be the George Washington of Ghana. And many of the political scientists were somehow sympathetic. People like David Apter talk about Ghana, Gold Coast in transition, and he felt that Nkrumah's charismatic leadership could be utilized to make sure that you have institutional transfer. The British parliamentary democratic model would then be replicated in Ghana through Kwame Nkrumah's intervention as a charismatic leader. Of course, this did not happen. Instead, a one-party state was established. Now, this leads me to the other model, which is a rival to the Gambian constitutional democratic model, and that is the existence in many parts of Africa of the one-party state, which became dominant at the time of decolonization and became much more consolidated in the post-colonial period. And in many of these countries, the presidency is patterned after the American presidency in the English-speaking countries, like in Tanzania. In the French-speaking countries, it is very much patterned after Gaulle's France, where the president is very much like what people like Lester Lipson would consider constitutional monarchs of some sort, or presidential monarchs of the European variety. And you find that Leopold Senghor of Senegal ruled Senegal for many years very much in the Gaullist mold with a one-party state. And then, of course, towards the end of his rule in 1980, he decided to open up the system to other parties. But there is a very interesting point here, and that is a man who was elected at one point in his political career to lead the country decided to determine the number of opposition parties to be formed. In a democratic society, you do not determine who should be a member of the opposition. It should be on an individual basis. You decide whether you are a member of the opposition or not. And this is precisely what has happened in Senegal. The same thing is true in Ivory Coast. So from a comparative point of view, what one can say is that the democratic constitutional model, which is being played out in the Gambia and in Botswana, because these are two exceptions in the African continent, is yet to be duplicated in many of the other countries. And this leads me to my last point, the question of size. some people have argued that size does make a difference. And if you are going to have a democratic government where people participate, the lesser the number of people, the greater the chances for a democratic political order to emerge. Of course, people like Aristotle thought that certain requirements were needed in order to establish the politeia, which was the best kind of polis. And in the case of the Gambia, the population at the time of independence was very small, 250,000. And of course now it is almost 750,000 after 25 years. And the size is still manageable. The political leadership is able to travel throughout the country and to interact with the people. So this, to some extent, enables the leadership to have contact and Meet the Farmers program of the president enables him to do that. Now, this may not be possible in a country like Nigeria with 100 million people. And this also creates a problem. So the size of the country most probably explain part of the success of the constitutional democratic experiment in the Gambia. And the fact that people in the Gambia are not as ethnic conscious as in other parts of Africa. That doesn't mean to say ethnicity is not a factor in the life of the people. So this willingness to mix with people of other groups and the accessibility of the leaders to the general public together enable the Gambian leaders to govern and to experiment. Now, another point which is related to the question of size is the manner in which the president of the country and his coterie of associates run the country. How do they relate to the opposition groups? Now, the Gambian experiment was almost aborted in 1981. When you had a coup attempt in July of 81, when some elements who projected themselves as Marxist-Leninist in a bizarre way tried to take over the government, but were crushed by the army of Senegal. And this sad episode in Gambian political development was most likely going to undermine the constitutional process. So the question of size becomes very important. And I think some of the Africans usually tell us, when Gambians tell them about the democratic experiment, that, well, you know, you are small, that's why you people can do it. But I don't think size matters, because here, America provides a contrast to the Gambia, because if the Americans, with over 200 million people and a continental state, can experiment with representative democracy, there is no excuse for Africans from big countries like Zaire and Nigeria not to try the democratic process. Now, some African critics would say, but the founding fathers of the United States were much more united and they had a lot of things in common which do not exist in the case of the African leaders of these multi-ethnic societies. And this creates a problem. So size may still be a factor. And if size is not a factor, the ability of the elites to interact and to agree on the rules of the game becomes very important. Now, in concluding my presentation, what I would say is that the American legacy or the American impact in the field of constitution making in Africa has come in two ways. It has come through the post-colonial political engineering of African leaders who try to establish presidential republican governments and have incorporated in their constitution some of the tested and tried principles and techniques of government in the United States. It has come indirectly through the British, because the African constitution of the British variety, or the pattern after the British Westminster model, and the American constitution have a common genealogy going back to Britain, because American constitution reflects a continuity from the pre-revolutionary period, and at the same time, an innovation. The Americans brought into the political consciousness of mankind the possibility of having a government whose head is selected by his peers. He is not a warlord who exercises rule and domination by virtue of might. In America, faith in the Almighty, in the sense that all men are created equal, which is echoed in the Declaration of Independence, means to say that, unlike George Orwell's Animal Farm, some are more equal than others, because that's the only way you can justify and legitimize monarchy. And in the American experiment, monarchical principles were jettisoned, and individual rights and the selection of the individual by his peers to assume the reins of government became enshrined. Those African countries that are now traveling along the democratic constitutional path are very much guided by this American innovation, the political radar of American ingenuity. And I would say that in the Gambian experiment, the Gambians may not have the size of the United States, may not have the population of the United States, may not have the economic wherewithal of the United States, but in the impoverished state they are in, they are struggling with a democracy. Or whether you're going to have a democracy which involves the powerful and the powerless in terms of economic resources, and still have the rule of law and the maintenance of justice. So in conclusion, I would say, yes, the American Constitution has provided a lesson not only to the Africans, but to the world at large. And the Africans do benefit from the ideas of the American Revolution. And in this case, constitution building may not be a replication of what has transpired in America, but indeed the source of inspiration, or the sources of inspiration, can be found in America. The Gambians are experimenting with the democratic constitutional model, and they recognize the fact that unless the constitutional principle is homegrown, it will not last. A lesson from America is, you may be inspired by others, but in the end, it is your successful adaptation of the borrowed theory that would make a difference. So if freedom is to prevail in Gambian society, the Gambians must indigenize and domesticate what is perceived to be borrowed theory. Thank you very much.
Wow.
when one hears so lucid a presentation, you always wonder, what is the interconnection between the oral tradition in Africa and the capacity to grapple with these problems? Who'd like to ask the first question? Joe, would you like to ask early rather than late your question? Joe Miller, as everybody knows, is our foremost Africanist at UVA.
So I wondered, you gave us a lot of the general principles and theories about both U.S. constitutionalism and the situation as you see it in Gambia. But I wonder if you could go back over briefly the last 25 years in the Gambia and give us a brief political history, as it were, indicating some of the issues that have tested these principles, or some of the events that have allowed President Jawara to implement these rules. And it was give us a little more concrete substance behind the theory that you've laid out so lucidly so far.
Yes, over the last, since the declaration, since the attainment of independence in 65, the Gambia has successfully grappled with many of the problems, except for the July 81 coup attempt. Now, in 1965, there were two major political parties in the country. You have the PPP, which is the People's Progressive Party, the ruling party, and the United Party. These two political parties were divided along regional and ethnic lines, if you are to consider the leaders of the two different parties. At the time, the polarization was serious because the urban areas were controlled by the United Party, whose leader was, until 1962, the chief minister, meaning the leader of the government. But he was defeated in the 1962 election, supervised by the British, and Jawara took over the premiership of the country. Now, in 1964, one of Jawara's political opponents, who was one of the leading politicians in the urban areas, bolted the party and formed the Gambia People's Party. Now, there is very interesting development with regard to the emergence of this political party. Mr. Jahumpa is the name of this fellow. Jahumpa was a Muslim fundamentalist of some sort, if we had to use that term retroactively, in the sense that he was saying that in the 50s, he was telling the British that, well, the Christian minority was favored by the British, and that the Muslims majority did not have access to government jobs. So he created a political party out of the Gambia Muslim Society. So here you have a test of separation of church and state coming up. And in 1964, he bolted the ruling party because he was defeated in the polls. He didn't have a seat in parliament, and he didn't have a ministerial position. Government didn't give any position. So he decided to form a new party. But what has happened is that from 51, when he founded the Gambia Muslim Congress, to 1964, the society has undergone significant changes. It was no longer popularly acceptable for you to bring religion into politics. And this was likely because as the society moves towards independence, religion was now becoming less significant, and ethnic identity or regional identity was assuming greater significance. So when he founded his new party in 64, he dropped the word Muslim out of his party's name. It was no longer the Gambia Muslim Congress, it was now the Gambia Congress Party. And this was a very important development, and I think the political leaders in the country made sure that religion was no longer used as a way of dividing the people, thereby jeopardizing the political process and undermining the constitution of the country. Now, another test case came up in 1972. The vice president of the Gambia, Mr. Diba, was very much compromised by his brother, the so-called Butut affairs. The Butut is the penny of the Gambia, what you call the penny in the United States. Now, in Senegal, the women like to use the Butut to make ornamentation. You know, they wear it, you know, make that, or they have chains of it for themselves. So the the younger brother of the vice president was apprehended by the Senegalese authorities with bags of coins, which he was trying to smuggle into the neighboring country so that he can make a lot of money. And of course, this was a big embarrassment to the government. I mean, here was the vice president's brother smuggling Gambian currency across the neighboring state. And of course, the vice president was called by the president and he was fired. So, I mean, you know, like, this created a big uprising in, because he had his constituency, he had his followers. And the government was based on a very, very delicate balancing of regional and ethnic groups. So when this Butut affair broke out, the president was faced with a question of how do you go about dealing with your vice presidents? I mean, you know, like, in an ethnic conscious society. And the thing is, it happened that he came from the same ethnic group, but they also belong to different regions in the country. And even though they are, when it comes to alliance making, they identify with each other. But when it comes to among themselves, they fight each other for control, for power. So this created a big problem. But in the end, what happened really was the president was able to preempt any kind of challenge to his political rule, thereby leading to a constitutional crisis, when he decided to take the matter to the party executive, and then, of course, to a party congress, and he was cleared, and thereby neutralizing his vice president, and of course the vice president was gradually eased out, and he eventually left the party and formed an opposition party. Now, unlike many of the other African countries, this would not have happened. He was most probably going to be jailed, as it happened in Ghana under Nkrumah and some of the other places, and he would not be allowed to form an opposition party. Preventive Detention Act would have been promulgated by the president. So in this case, the vice president, in terms of constitutional crisis, the vice president, who was very powerful, was allowed to form an opposition party, the National Convention Party, and he was able to operate freely without being challenged, something that would be very rare in many parts of the continent, because if you're a vice president, as in Kenya, you have what happened to Odinga when he challenged Jomo Kenyatta, the same kind of scenario. He was jailed. And this happens in many other countries. So in this case, the integrity of the constitution was maintained.
Next question.
Yes,
Bob Kretzinger, Professor Kretzinger.
One has the impression that many of the present boundaries were drawn by colonial powers without real regard to ethnic grouping or ethnic divisions. You know, within our constitutional history, we've been able to incorporate an expanding country. We had one crisis when there was an attempt to divide the country. How permanent do you think the national borders of Gambia and neighboring states are? And would any potential change be the result of warfare? Are there any constitutional provisions for flexibility?
Yeah, well, see, that's a very good question. And I think the African leaders are being asked all the time, when are the borders going to disappear? Now, unfortunately, since independence, the African leaders themselves have legitimized the borders, because the Organization of African Unity carries a provision to the effect that borders are permanent. I mean, the Article 2, Paragraph 7 of the United Nations is very much replicated in the OAU Charter, which virtually talks about domestic jurisdiction. So the boundary, that's one of the reasons why the Somalis have a lot of difficulties in Africa, because they're challenging the legitimacy of the colonial boundaries between themselves and the Kenyans and between themselves and the Ethiopians. Now, in the case of Gambia, the Gambians and the Senegalese are cousins. Historically, we are the same people. We have the same ethnic composition. However, the colonial experience has created a new sense of identity among Gambians and Senegalese, to the extent that the elites, who are the people that count, do not want to see the dissolution of Gambian sovereignty. I mean, so Gambians would quickly remind you that they are not going to sacrifice their sovereignty on the altar of Senegambian solidarity. So, I mean, you know, like, this is something which is very much there. And this creates a serious problem with regard to, I think we have witnessed the coagulation of colonial boundaries. And I think people like Julius Nyerere, who at one time talks about Pan-Africanism and the need for regional unity, recognize the sacrosanct nature of the colonial boundaries. There's a paradox in African politics and in African societies. At one level, the African intellectuals and leaders would advocate Pan-Africanism, the dream for the unification of the whole continent, but they are quite reluctant to dissolve the colonial boundaries so as to have piecemeal unity. For example, if the Gambians and the Senegalese can form a union, this should serve as the basis for greater unity in the region, and then you can incorporate other states. But the Gambian leaders are very reluctant to do that. Since the coup attempt in 81, the Gambians have signed a number of protocols and agreements with Senegal, protocols which were originally intended to bring the two countries together. Except for security, the two countries are still far from each other.
Other questions? Could I ask one final question, maybe? Yes.
You spoke of regionalism. Is that the coastal area as against the upriver areas?
The regionalism in Africa, of course, we talk about West African region, and they have grouped themselves under the name of ECOWAS, the Economic Community of West African State, ECOWAS. And then you have the SADC, Southern African Development countries, coordinated countries over there. And you have the East African countries that were grouped under the East African Community. And then, of course, you have the Central African countries, which has a French acronym, UDAC, that are grouped together. So the African leaders have always been divided into three groups. You have those who are Pan-Africanists, continental Pan-Africanists, as Nkrumah, who wanted to see the whole continent united. Nkrumah was very much influenced by America, and he felt that Africans should repeat the American experience by creating larger units, because African states are too small. Then you have the people like Nyerere, who wanted to have a step-by-step approach to unity. Let us unite East Africa first, and then we can unite with our brothers in Central, Southern, and West Africa. Okay, then you have the micro-nationalists, who are mainly in the bureaucracies of these African governments. They don't want any unity. They have the cake in front of them, and they want to have the biggest slice. They are not too sure. Their knife will not reach the cake if it is expanded to the other side, so they want to have it closer to home, and this is exactly what is happening in Africa.
Just one, unless others had one final thought. We have so much difficulty in determining what is really fundamental in this society, American society, in terms of the means of democracy. For instance, I lived in Westchester County, and we had something called the Town Club, and we had regular debates about issues. It was it was the town meeting pattern. Virginia doesn't have a town meeting. The new president of the University of Virginia has tried to pump life into the Senate, and those of you around the table remember that his predecessor was inclined not to have as much of a role for the Senate. But one sometimes wonders how fundamental any of these means are compared with the esprit, the mystique of democracy that underlies these different means. And this must be true, I suppose, in Africa too. Aristotle talked about the best regime, the best ideal regime, and the best regime under the circumstances, and with a lot of variations of that. And I remember arguments in policy groups when people were just beginning to get interested in Africa, and the argument went a little bit like this. Well, there is this one-party system, and Nasser is the model, but Nasser holds out the prospect that when there's more stability and more growth, there will be a multi-party system. That's one hope we have about democracy in Africa. The other argument, though, that I remember some of these same people tilting toward a little bit in their thinking was that the military is necessary in order to create order. If order is not in existence in developing countries, you won't get justice and equality. Order has to precede justice and equality in all political thinking, it said. And the other advantage of the military over the one-party system, these people used to say, was that the military, by and large, were more likely to have been trained in an American context and therefore might be more willing to abandon one-party rule or military rule, since they had absorbed some of these ideas in military programs. But these are old arguments. They go back to the 60s at the time of independence. And I wonder if, looking at that whole area, do you have any conclusions you would draw about them?
Yes, I think, you know, like you summarized the literature at the time. This is the reference group theory of Price, you know, walking out of Ghana, trying to suggest that the military leaders like Afrifa and others would be very much inculcated with the Anglo-Saxon value of the military staying in the barracks and leaving the civilians to run governments. Unfortunately, this has not been vindicated by the train of events in Africa. The military see themselves as players. So, I mean, and this is precisely why Seru Sagari would make that argument in Nigeria, that you have two political parties, the military and the civilians, because the military sees itself as players in the political process. And in the case of Nigeria, the military has now built itself as kingmakers and the ones who will enable the constitution to become a reality. There was also an argument, you know, which people like, I see him now in retrospect as an academic grandfather of some sort, people like Rupert Emerson and others, I mean, you know, like, who very much were very sympathetic to the Africans at the time of decolonization. And there was the hope in certain political science circles in America, the social scientists in the 60s, that may be the one-party state. I remember reading an article in the British Journal of Sociology, a British anthropologist trying to make a case for the one-party state, saying that it is very much similar to the traditional African mode of governance. But the problem is all institutions that are designed by men to restore justice and freedom are fragile. It is the men who run the institutions that make the difference. Democracy is not protected by a constitution or by the institutions. It is protected by the collective effort of men in time. And a system can always be subverted, no matter how hard you create it. You can create checks and balances in the system. But if you have corrupt men manning the strategic centers of power, the system will collapse, and freedom and justice will disappear from the face of the earth. And I think this is something we have to take into account. institution building is a long-term effort, and it is the collective effort of each generation that reinforces or tear down what we call the constitution. And I think in Africa, the Africans cannot go any other way. That's the only way. There are people like Nyerere who felt that the one-party state would resolve the quest and would lead to the realization of a democratic order. And in their own way, they have worked out a system whereby the rank-and-file members of the party, including cabinet ministers, can be chased out of office. But they still have not worked out a system, in my view, whereby the presidency can be challenged. I mean, an opposition leader can aspire for the presidency, to the presidency, and then challenge successfully the incumbent. Now, should that happen, that a person can challenge the incumbent and then replaces him peacefully without any kind of military intervention or violence, then you have a system that works. So it is the men who make a difference. And Nyerere reminded his fellow Africans by saying, democracy is a system which has faith in human nature. Without that, there is no democracy. Because if you don't have faith in human nature, that human beings can be morally sophisticated and morally responsible to govern according to the wishes of the electors, then you cannot have any kind of democratic system. And I think the Africans are going to be faced with these questions. In their own way, they would have to innovate new institutions, new techniques that would reinforce and strengthen these principles.
Every now and then the Department of Government gets arrogant and they say when some younger scholar emerges, it's all Professor Claude, Professor Fernbach, Professor Mosier, Professor Henry and others who are responsible. But we know that that's not true. We know that there are qualities that lead to the growth and development of a young scholar such as we've witnessed today, and we're very pleased that you've come back to your home, and we hope you come many, many times in the future.
Thank you very much.